From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
What we know about ourselves is that we crave information, but our brains aren't all that good at processing the speed of data and information coming at us all the time now. And as a result, I think we become more superficial thinkers, even as we have access to more and more information opened up to us.
So do we now have too much information? Or as Nicholas Carr put it in a famous magazine story, is Google making us stupid? Today we'll examine the pleasures and perils of information and look back at its history. Believe it or not, even the ancient Romans complained about information overload. Also, why some physicists now believe information is the underlying fabric of the universe, which may work like a giant cosmic computer.
It's fashionable to say that nature is in effect a computational process, that everything that happens in nature, every time an atom bangs into another atom, it's really like flipping bits, zeros and ones and so on.
Ooh, hold up, before we get started.
Guess who's coming?
It's...
Guess who's coming?
It's...
Guess who's coming?
Well, before we get started, maybe we need a definition. What exactly is information? The answer is more complicated than you'd think. In fact, the Oxford English Dictionary's newly revised definition runs some 9,400 words long. But that's nothing compared to James Gleick's new book, The Information, which logs in at well over 500 pages. Gleick is an acclaimed science writer, and his book is a sweeping history of information. He tells Steve Paulson that various information technologies, starting with the invention of writing, have changed the very nature of human consciousness. But to understand our modern information age, you have to go back 60 years to a mathematical breakthrough.
The central thing that happens, from which everything else flows, is that engineers define information mathematically. And they did that in 1948, and they used as a unit of measure the word bit, the smallest possible unit of information, on or off, yes or no, true or false. But we humans need our definition, too. I think you could say that information is how we know.
How we know as opposed to what we know?
Yes. It used to be just a general thing like instructions or news or gossip. For us, information includes sounds, it includes music, because we can store it on a compact disc and transmit it from one computer to another. It includes images, it includes television signals, and anything that can be reduced to bits and bytes stored in our computers and transmitted.
So the really radical idea that came out of information theory, going back to the founder, Claude Shannon, in 1948, was that information is not about meaning. It's not about conveying a particular message. Basically, it's just an arrangement of symbols to create order out of randomness.
Claude Shannon had to mathematicize the idea of information to suit his purposes, which were the construction of a mathematical theory of information. By making information a thing that scientists could talk about, he, without particularly intending to, opened the floodgates. Because when information theory was born, all kinds of areas of science woke up and paid attention. Psychologists started to rethink their basic subject matter. Biologists at that time were discovering the molecular construction of genes and, not coincidentally, adopted all of the language of information to understand what they were talking about.
And when you think about it, the genetic code, DNA sequencing, is a construction of different bits of information in a certain order that then leads to all life.
That's right. It's an alphabet. You can say it's an alphabet of four chemical characters. It's something that conveys instructions, on how to build an organism. These words, alphabet and instructions and memory and code, these are the words of information science adopted by biology and not just as metaphors, because that's what we're really made of. At the core of all of this stuff is information.
Well, let's talk about a few of the key stages in the evolution of information technology. And this goes back millennia, maybe to when our ancestors first learned how to speak. But let's pick up the story a little bit later. The invention of writing.
The first key technology of information was writing, which was a technology. It was an invention. It changed people in ways that are difficult for us to appreciate now. The transition from oral culture to literate culture was monumental. We can only make guesses about it because before there was writing, there was no history. So it's hard for us to reconstruct the way people thought in a purely oral culture. There are very few places on earth where people are still pre-literate. So to some extent, we can only make guesses, but they're intelligent guesses. And one thing we know is that without writing, there is no history. Without writing, there is no formal logic. Without writing, there's no mathematics. A lot of the way we think about the world depended on this one invention, and also the organization of human societies. People who controlled the scribes had enormous power. It was no coincidence that government and law and bureaucracy were all about writing.
And it's worth pointing out that not everyone at the dawn of writing was a fan of this invention. Plato famously didn't like writing at all.
Well, with every new information technology, there are worries. And yes, Plato thought writing was going to be dangerous. Before writing, people had to rely on their memories. And the faculty of memory was part of what made us so wonderful and human. And if people got lazy and couldn't remember things anymore, he worried that we would be lesser creatures. But of course, the irony is that without the invention of writing, we wouldn't know anything about Plato.
Now, we've been talking about the revolution that came with the invention of writing, but oral cultures had their own systems of communicating information. And you have a fascinating chapter on tribal drumming practices in the Congo and how this could convey key bits of news over long distances. Can you explain how this worked?
I write about the talking drums of Africa partly because they were such a mystery to the Europeans who first arrived in Africa. Often those Europeans were slavers, so they weren't particularly interested in understanding what they were seeing. But they were mystified by the ability of Africans to send messages. We're talking about in the 17th and 18th centuries now, the ability of Africans to send complex messages over tens of miles in a matter of minutes. On a quiet night, the drums could be heard, say, 5 or 6 miles, and then the messages could be relayed. That meant that African cultures had something that European cultures did not and had dreamed of, which is a means of communication that traveled faster than any person could travel. That didn't arrive in Europe until the telegraph in the 19th century. And of course, the telegraph changed everything. But in Africa, even in languages that did not have writing, there was this ability that had evolved to send messages absolutely as complex as any spoken language over long distances. So not only was that a surprise to Europeans, it also was a puzzle. The puzzle was, how did they do it? With the Morse code, the secret involved an intermediate layer of alphabet. Morse code was dots and dashes that were translated into letters. And without the letters, you wouldn't have anything to encode. In African languages, where there was no alphabet, it was a puzzle how they managed to create this complex and sophisticated drum language.
So there was a certain sequence of drumming that communicated particular messages. For instance, the stranger has arrived in my village. Somehow you could communicate that to the next village through this,
the drum
this
messages
pattern of drums.
Yes, they tended to be very elaborate, very ornate, very poetic. It reminds me really of Homer's oral language in his poetry, where he would repeat phrases and use little poetic snippets, the wine dark sea, to aid memory. And we would now say as a form of error correction.
Now, you mentioned the telegraph. This was certainly one of the most revolutionary developments in information technology. It came into common use in the mid-19th century. Why was this such a radical invention?
I was surprised myself by how interesting the telegraph turned out to be. When I started working on the book, I think I imagined that I would write a lot about the telephone and how that changed culture, and that the telegraph would make a cameo appearance. But it was really the other way around. The telegraph was so transformative. And I'm not the first person to have noticed that the telegraph, in a way, was a predecessor of the modern internet. So many of the things that we see in our time, the things people say, the hype about how the internet is annihilating time and space and enabling instantaneous communication, people said all those things about the telegraph. What's less obvious was how many fundamental concepts changed very quickly. Before the telegraph, there was no sense of simultaneity. There was no standard time. It didn't really occur to people to worry about whether people 100 miles away were setting their clocks identically to the way they were setting their own clocks. It didn't matter, and there was no way to know, so it simply didn't exist.
So we've been talking about key stages in the development of information technology. Do you see internet technology as just a continuation of the other kinds of technologies we've been talking about, or has there been something fundamentally new that's been created here?
I think it's a continuation and it is something altogether new. Or you could say, people have said that in a way we're returning to a kind of oral culture where people are speaking one to another intimately. Twitter is, on the one hand, a very public and global kind of communication, and on the other hand, it's an extremely intimate kind of communication, people talking to friends in small groups, but all at once, billions of messages together.
Now, the basic premise of your book is that information is the lifeblood of the world we live in. It's what makes the world go. How far are you willing to take that idea? How much is it embedded into our daily lives?
I think we all know that it's crucial to our daily lives. We all think of ourselves, consciously or unconsciously, as information experts. We are aficionados of information and information hobbyists. And people are starting to feel that if they aren't connected for a few minutes, they're suffocating. Information is like air. If it's cut off, we start to choke. That sounds like hype maybe, but people who are listening might recognize themselves in that description. There's a downside to that. It's valuable sometimes not to be connected, to be isolated, to be alone with our thoughts, or if not with our thoughts, at least in a comfortable chair with a good long book. But we like being able to take a device out of our pocket or look at a screen and get an answer to a question that in another era might have taken days of research or months of study. Now the whole world, it seems, is accessible to us.
Now, there are, of course, many critics of new technology, including people who work in the technology industry. And the common complaint is that we just simply have too much of it. We're swimming in information, and we don't know how to sort out all the junk from what is important. And another way to put it is perhaps the amount of information is inversely proportional to the wisdom that we can glean.
It feels that way. That's our modern predicament. It's paradoxical that being able to find out facts, being able to answer virtually any factual question in just a few seconds doesn't necessarily make us any smarter. We do know that information is not knowledge and knowledge is not wisdom.
Well, we started the conversation by saying that really what launched the information revolution, or at least information theory, was the idea that information was not about meaning. It was not about any particular message. And, of course, that's the complaint, that we've lost meaning in all of this sea of information.
That's the paradox. The removal of meaning from the picture by engineers created a thing that is not so friendly to humans. And meaning is all we care about. So the challenge is to take the morass of information in which we find ourselves and find the bits of meaning again.
Hmm. You end your book by referencing a short story by Jorge Luis Borges, The Library of Babel. Why does this fable resonate with you?
Borges was a kind of prophet. It's amazing that he wrote this story when he did, because when you read it, you can't help but feel he's describing our world. He imagines an infinite library where every book exists. Walk the endless corridors and you see all of the true histories and all of the false histories. And the problem is that when you have every book, you have no book because you can never tell what's true and what's nonsense.
James Glick talking with Steve Paulson about his book, The Information. We were so intrigued by the visionary quality of the Library of Babel, which Borges wrote 70 years ago, that we wanted to sample a bit of it. The universe, which others call the library, is composed of an indefinite and perhaps infinite number of hexagonal galleries, with vast air shafts between, surrounded by very low railings. From any of the hexagons, one can see interminably the upper and lower floors. The distribution of the galleries is invariable. 20 shelves, 5 long shelves per side, cover all the sides except 2. Their height, which is the distance from floor to ceiling, scarcely exceeds that of a normal bookcase. One of the free sides leads to a narrow hallway, which opens onto another gallery, identical to the first, and to all the rest. When it was proclaimed that the library contained all books, the first impression was one of extravagant happiness. All men felt themselves to be the masters of an intact and secret treasure. There was no personal or world problem whose eloquent solution did not exist in some hexagon. The universe was justified. The universe suddenly usurped the unlimited dimensions of hope. At that time, a great deal was said about the Vindications, books of apology and prophecy which vindicated for all time the acts of every man in the universe and retained prodigious arcana for his future. Thousands of the greedy abandoned their sweet native hexagons and rushed up the stairways, urged on by the vain intention of finding their vindication. These pilgrims disputed in the narrow corridors, proffered dark curses, strangled each other on the divine stairways, flung the deceptive books into the air shafts, met their death, cast down in a similar fashion by the inhabitants of remote regions. Others went mad. The Vindications exist. I have seen 2 which refer to persons of the future, to persons who perhaps are not imaginary. But the searchers did not remember that the possibility of a man's finding his vindication, or some treacherous variation thereof, can be computed as 0. The methodical task of writing distracts me from the present state of men. The certitude that everything has been written negates us, or turns us into phantoms. I know of districts in which the young men prostrate themselves before books and kiss their pages in a barbarous manner, but they do not know how to decipher a single letter. Epidemics, heretical conflicts, have decimated the population. I believe I have mentioned the suicides, more and more frequent with the years. Perhaps my old age and fearfulness deceive me, but I suspect that the human species, the unique species, is about to be extinguished. But the library will endure, illuminated, solitary, infinite, perfectly motionless, equipped with precious volumes, useless, incorruptible, secret. Excerpts from The Library of Babel by Jorge Luis Borges. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
A few years ago, the Atlantic Monthly ran a controversial piece called "Is Google Making Us Stupid?" The blogosphere exploded in debate, and writer Nicholas Carr expanded his article into a book, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. Carr himself was an early adopter of computer technology and once reveled in the ease with which he could cruise around the Internet. But then he realized he'd gotten so hooked on quick hits of information that he was losing the ability to focus on one thing for any length of time. Now, he believes this glut of information is actually rewiring our brains.
What we know about ourselves is that we crave information. We crave new messages, new stimuli. And there seems to be things going on, you know, deep inside of our brain with, you know, the release of chemicals like dopamine, which produces pleasure, that we receive whenever we find a new bit of information. You know, you can understand that as being a very primitive instinct. In primitive days, you know, being aware of everything going on around you probably helped you stay alive. But we've replaced our natural environment with a digital environment that is incredibly rich with information and data. And unfortunately, our brains aren't all that good at processing the amount and the speed of data and information coming at us all the time now. And we literally kind of overload our short-term working memory. And as a result, I think we become more superficial thinkers, even as we have access to more and more information opened up to us.
So give me an example. I mean, you're a reader, you're a writer. You know that in your case, and you make the case in the book, that having more information is, at least in theory, going to make your life easier because you no longer have to make a trip to the library. You don't have to travel to a different city to look at a document. It's all right there at your fingertips. What's going on that isn't good?
Because it's all there all the time, and because we so love to be aware of everything going on around us, we short-circuit our attentiveness. When an important piece of information, whether it's text or video or whatever, comes at us, you know, rather than screening out other stuff and not paying attention to distractions and interruptions and focusing on that one important thing for a long period of time, we simply allow ourselves, because the technology is so good at it, to be constantly distracted, constantly interrupted. We glance at, you know, a new email or a new text message or a new Facebook update or a new tweet coming at us. I think the technology puts its emphasis on the gathering of information, the very fast-paced gathering of information, which is one element certainly in having a rich intellectual life. But it de-emphasizes and doesn't really give us any opportunity or encouragement to pay deep attention to one thing.
Well, let's make it practical too, because you make the case that it is not simply a matter of being distracted while you're at the computer. This bleeds off into other parts of your life. Reading books becomes more difficult than it used to be because they don't offer up the mass of information at the same speed and with the same variety that we've become accustomed to.
That's right. And in fact, writing about this subject, I was originally inspired to do it from my own experience of really having problems sitting down and reading a book or a long article. And what I found is that after, you know, a couple of pages or even a couple of paragraphs, my mind got antsy and it wanted to behave the way I've trained it to behave when I'm looking at a computer screen. It didn't want to focus on one linear argument or story. It wanted to jump from page to page, to click on links, to do some Googling, to check email. I think what that shows us is how powerfully technologies can alter the way we think. And they do that by changing our habits of mind, changing our expectations, and our brains and our mind kind of adapt very well to new tools. We're very good at using them. The problem is that adaptation can be either good or bad or a mixture. And I think the loss of attentiveness, the loss of the ability to concentrate, therefore translates into a deeper loss of the ability to be contemplative and reflective and introspective.
One of the most disturbing parts of the argument is that our brains are trying to do us a favor by adjusting to this. You talk about the plasticity of the brain and some of the research that shows that over the centuries, our brains have had to adapt to new and different things. If you lose a limb, you found the brain uses the neural endings that it used to use for that limb and applies them to something else. This is a good thing, except when your habits become so ingrained, in this case with the immediacy of the internet, that your brain starts to shut off the ways you used to work.
That's right. I mean, there's all sorts of very, very good things about the fact that our brains are so adaptable and so plastic and so ready to respond to changes in the environment. On the other hand, what our brains seem to be interested in is efficiency. The physical structure of our brains doesn't really make value judgments about how we think. It simply adapts to the way we use it. So if we spend all of our time juggling information and multitasking and shifting our focus very quickly, our brain optimizes itself to do that. But if we start to not pay attention, not sustain our attention on one thing, not engage in more meditative thought, our brain is very happy to begin to weaken those processes even as it strengthens the other.
One of the interesting things for me was thinking about applying this to my own life. You talk about the way in which newspapers are now available online. And I think you said at one point that you no longer subscribed to newspapers because you could read them all on the web. I still find I read the New York Times differently when I have the newspaper in my hands than I do when I try to read the same article on the web. I find reading long articles on the computer more difficult. I want it to be over so I can go to the next thing, whereas when I have the paper in my hand, it feels right and proper to read through to the end of an article.
And I have to say I've changed and I've gone back to subscribing to paper newspapers for just that reason. I mean, originally, you know, I was reading articles online like we all do, and the newspaper would come and I'd say, gee, I saw this headline already. And I thought, why am I paying for this? But I did notice that I wasn't engaging as deeply with news stories as I did when I did have a piece of paper in front of me. You know, the great thing I think about the printed page as a technology is that nothing else is going on other than the words on the page or the pictures on the page. And I think that trains us to pay attention. The computer screen, the networked computer screen, is almost exactly the opposite. It doesn't shield us from distraction. It makes sure we're constantly receive these pulses of new information. So I do think the experience, even when the content is exactly the same, the experience changes depending on which medium or which technology you're using.
But again, I want to think about this mass of information that is available on the internet. And it is all but impossible not to want access to that information, even though we're aware that it is changing us.
You know, I want to emphasize that having access to more information is a good thing. The problem comes in when the way we access that information simply makes the gathering of information the overriding priority. You know, until recently, when we thought about the use of our mind, thinking had two steps. You gather information, and then you think about it deeply and personally and make your own connections in your mind and whatever. With the internet and with digital media in general, I think all the emphasis is shifting to that first step, the gathering of information, certainly an important step. But we're beginning to redefine our intellectual lives to say, well, that second step, when we step back from the flow of information and think deeply and even, you know, contemplatively and reflectively about the information, maybe that's not important. Maybe it's all about just the efficiency of gathering information. We have to be conscious and aware of the way we – not only do we adapt our thinking when new technologies come along, but we even begin to change the way we – what types of thinking we value and what types of thinking we think are dispensable.
You have some personal experience of this, don't you? In the process of writing this book, you made a conscious decision to reduce the effect of the internet on you?
I did, and I certainly continued to gain huge value from the internet as a research tool. As a writer, I can tell you that it speeds up a whole lot of things that used to take a lot of time. But I did a few things. I dropped off of social networks, like I had had a Twitter account and a Facebook account. And I dropped off of those, not because I don't see the value of them, but because they are set up to kind of beam little bits of intriguing information at you all day. And that's incredibly disrupting, incredibly interrupting. And I also made a conscious decision that I'd use the web for what I think it's very good at, which is discovering relevant and interesting new information. But then once I'd found it, I made a point of going to a library or a bookstore and actually trying to get the original article or book. And I'd sit down and read it in print. And I found just those fairly small changes in my behavior actually did have a big effect on me. And I found in not too long of a period, my attention span seemed to be strengthening and, you know, my ability to concentrate seemed to be coming back. So the good news is that the plasticity of our brain goes both ways. And if we change our habits, we can regain some of the things we might have lost.
That's Nicholas Carr. His book is called The Shallows: What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains.
What's wrong?
Information overload may seem like a quintessentially 21st century problem, but more than 2,000 years ago, people complained about the very same thing. The rise of the printed word and the creation of the printing press also flooded the world with vast new streams of information. And it took people a while to figure out how to store and manage all the new knowledge. Historian Anne Blair charts this history in her book, Too Much to Know. Anne Strainchamp spoke with her.
We tend to think of information overload as a distinctly modern problem, especially now in the internet age. But your work suggests that people worried about this for centuries.
Absolutely. The theme of there being too much to know, too many books to read, goes really way back. But I like to focus especially on the first century of the Common Era, so a contrast between two Romans, Seneca on the one hand and Pliny on the other. The Seneca line is, too many books is distraction. Choose a few books, read them carefully and well. On the opposite, though, Pliny's concern is that too many books is good, but we need to master them all. His line is, there is no book so bad that some good cannot be gotten from it.
But this is fascinating that back before there even were printed books, people were already worried about the proliferation of information?
I would say so. It doesn't take much to overload the human brain. Once you have writing, you can accumulate texts across generations. The Library of Alexandria in the 3rd century before the Common Era was trying to keep a text of every single Greek text known. They would forcibly borrow texts from incoming ships, make copies to stock their library. So there was a sense of a corpus that you needed to hold and contain. And we don't really know how many texts they had, but basically hundreds of thousands of papyrus rolls were stored in that library before it burned, of course, in one of the great tragic moments of loss of learning.
Do you think people felt the same anxiety, the same sort of emotions that we feel when we feel inundated by too much information?
If you look at a Renaissance doctor like Girolamo Cardano, you know, he is a practicing physician. He has an abundant correspondence. He's trying to write books. He wrote dozens of them. He's clearly a man who's constantly pressed for time and who talks about how you should read a book in parts, marking the difficult passages to return to later. And even more amazing, he talks about how you can write a book by rearranging text that you or others have already written by cutting and pasting it in and slapping it onto pages to send to the printer. So shortcuts are definitely, you know, well known to scholars. Pliny, for example, he felt that any kind of reading that did not involve note-taking was idle. And so he only traveled by carriage because that way he could have someone take dictation. He was read to while eating, while bathing, and so on. So never a moment to waste is certainly a long-running concern of scholars.
So very early on, this obsession with note-taking picked up.
Well, note-taking is a way of recording the good stuff so that you can retrieve it later, so that you can share it with a later self or with other people. And so I think it's one of the first tools of information management.
Well, as note-taking developed and became the regular practice of any self-respecting scholar, then techniques for note-taking began to be developed. So what are some of the most famous note-taking techniques?
Well, the Renaissance pedagogues felt that young boys mostly were to start taking notes as soon as they could read, basically. They would underline the good bits in the books, and then they would copy them over onto separate notebooks, often copy them over twice, the idea being that the copying in itself was a way of slowing down the mind, forcing you to pay attention, and helping you to retain the material. Of course, at the scale of a lifetime, the idea was that you would accumulate notes throughout your reading, but also throughout your daily experience, conversations with people, and you would accumulate these things on the scale of volumes and volumes of notes. And, of course, then you had a problem that you couldn't actually remember what you'd taken, and so we get advice about how to index your notes.
You discovered something in the 17th century called a note closet?
So this is sort of like a large hanging closet, but turned into a storage for notes taken on slips of paper, whereby you would have many, many headings inscribed on pieces of wood, and behind each heading there would be a metal poker onto which you could stick basically your index card, your piece of paper. The great fear about taking notes on slips of paper is that they would blow away with an open window or an open door. And this note closet was a way of controlling that potential chaos by attaching the slip of paper to the heading under which it belonged. Of course, you can also rearrange the slip. That's the great power of it. And ultimately, as I discovered when I was working on how very big books were made in the early modern period, many of these note slips were used to actually compose from. So rather than going to the trouble of copying out your notes, you would take your notes and cut them into slips and then glue them onto the sheets of paper from which the printed book would be made.
You know, what's so remarkable listening to you is the technology has changed, but not our organizational practices. And what you just described is something we all do every day in basic word processing programs, cut and paste.
Absolutely. And it's been being done with scissors and glue and paper and ink on paper for many, many centuries.
So if people were at first concerned with simply taking notes and kind of culling the good stuff, at what point did people begin to think about how to organize, how to file all of this information so that somebody else could come along and find it?
Well, that's where the subject headings come in, and I think a crucial role for sorting information was played by printed books that offered you, in print, ready-made, the kinds of notes you wished you'd taken yourself but didn't have time to. So this is the encyclopedia, which doesn't have the title encyclopedia basically until, let's say, 1750 with the famous Encyclopédie of Diderot and d'Alembert. But it has the form of accumulating many bits of knowledge sorted, even already in the 13th century, if not before.
What are some of the other most famous early encyclopedias?
Well, one of my favorites is the blockbuster of the period, Theodor Zwinger's Theater of Human Life, where he offered basically a portrayal of all human behavior just as God will see at the Last Judgment. So only a slight bit of hubris there. And it starts at 1.5 million words. It grows in his lifetime to 4.5 million words and is copied, is sort of augmented in a sequel after his death to 10 million words. You should keep in mind that the 1985 last print edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica is 40 million words. So this is going from a tenth to a quarter the size of our latest print encyclopedia.
It's interesting because the way you describe it, there's sort of two competing instincts in human nature, I guess. There's information overload, and on the other hand, there's a lust for information. So then on the one hand, we complain about feeling that we're drowning in information, and we come up with strategies for organizing and condensing information, but we obviously have a tremendous appetite for it as well.
Absolutely. We have brought this on ourselves. We want all the information. I don't think there'd be many people out there who would be pleased to see the one Google hit that meets their needs gone because it was considered excessive. And in fact, the whole movement of deletionism within Wikipedia is a fascinating example of when is too much, and who's to decide. So in fact, the people who wrote the articles that others think are useless don't feel that way at all about it.
Anne Blair is a MacArthur Fellow and historian at Harvard University. She talked with Anne Strainchamps about her book, Too Much to Know, Managing Scholarly Information Before the Modern Age. Next, why some physicists believe information is the basic fabric of the universe. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Basic building blocks of the universe. The subatomic particles that make up everything we see in the cosmos? Or maybe the laws of physics, gravity, thermodynamics, and so on. Well, some physicists now claim there's something even more basic, information itself. They believe the universe works like a cosmic computer, constantly crunching tiny bits of information. But this isn't like any computer we know. It's a giant quantum computer of unimaginable complexity. So complex, in fact, it's actually a system of never-ending parallel universes. Steve Paulson found the whole thing pretty mind-boggling, so he asked the physicist Paul Davies to explain the idea.
To a physicist, information is much more of a fundamental concept. It really has to do with whether a physical system can exist in more than one state. And the classic example is the spin of an atom. We know from the rules of quantum physics that whenever you measure the spin of the atom, it lies either up or down, nowhere in between. And this is just like tossing a coin, heads and tails. And if you toss a coin and take a look at it and you find it's, for example, heads, then you gain a bit of information. It's as simple as that. It's when you select from a range of possibilities and find there is one actual outcome that you gain information. And ultimately, all science, all our experience of the world, all our observation comes from interrogating nature and gaining bits of information.
So it sounds like you're trying to apply the model of the computer to the universe itself. You're saying the universe works like some giant cosmic computer, and computers, as far as I know, deal in this binary world of, as you say, it's either one thing or the opposite thing. It's never anything in between.
That's exactly right. And there is a sense in which every age likes to construct a worldview, a model of the universe, if you like, based on the pinnacle of its technology. Go back a couple of thousand years, the pinnacle of technology in those days were musical instruments and surveying instruments. So you think back to the Greeks. The ancient Greeks built a theory of the universe based on musical harmony and geometry. And we still use the term the music of the spheres. Then, about the time of Isaac Newton, the pinnacle of technology was the clock, the clockwork mechanism. And Newton built a clockwork universe based on that. And now, the computer is the pinnacle of technology, and so it's fashionable to say that nature is, in effect, a computational process. Now, you're bound to say, well, here we go again, and in another 100 years, someone will have a different idea. And I respond to that by saying, at the moment, the deepest that we can really go is to view nature as a computational process, that everything that happens in nature, every time an atom bangs into another atom, it's really like flipping bits, zeros and ones and so on. And you can really build a powerful image of the entire universe and everything that's going on in it in those terms.
So if all information is ultimately binary, I mean, it's either one thing or its opposite, is that to say that the universe can ultimately be reduced to yes-no questions?
Many people think that that is precisely right, that when we human beings make observations of the world, we're interrogating nature and we're getting yes-no answers. In the most primitive way, every scientific experiment consists of doing exactly that. Come back to the simple example I gave where it's obviously true. Did the electron bounce to the left or the right? You get yes-no answers. In the world of quantum physics, we get into another subtlety here, which is the possibility of a superposition. Now, you toss a coin, it's heads or tails. But in quantum physics, if you toss a quantum coin, and this might be a spin of a particle or something, you can have a little bit of heads and a lot of tails, or a little bit of tails and a lot of heads. You can have any mixture of the two. In other words, an atom, say, can be in a heads and tails state both at once. So in a sense, if we could take, as it were, a God's eye view and not a human view, whenever human beings make observations, they get definite yes-no answers. But if we could look at the world through these godlike eyes and see the superposition, we would see that it is more than just yes and no or ones and zeros. It's all possible amalgams of those. And this leads to the very fashionable but somewhat bizarre idea that there's not just one universe, but a vast, well, indeed an infinite assemblage of them, often called a quantum multiverse, in which all of these realities are actually somehow present in parallel.
This is all quite mind-boggling, I have to say. And it seems that what you're talking about is some combination of science and philosophy here. I mean, this would seem to go beyond the usual purview of science to get into even larger questions about what reality is all about.
You're exactly right. To talk about the existence of parallel realities makes sense to a scientist only if it's testable. And one of the arguments against this interpretation of quantum mechanics, and I have some distinguished colleagues who simply don't buy it, is that it doesn't really seem to be testable in any very obvious way. Now, there are people who say, in principle, we could test it. An old friend of mine in the UK, David Deutsch, who has been an evangelist for this quantum multiverse for many decades, conceived of an experiment in which you would build a conscious computer. But it would be a quantum computer. It would operate down at the level of atoms and molecules. So instead of flipping ones and zeros like the computer on my desk does, it would be flipping these ghostly superpositions. So we have all possible ones and zeros, often called qubits rather than bits. And people are now trying to build these quantum computers. They haven't got very far, but they're certainly trying. And so he envisaged a quantum computer that was conscious. You could have a conversation with it, where in effect it would be in like a sort of schizophrenic state where part of it would be experiencing one world and part of it would experience the other. But then you'd merge them back again into a single one, and then you'd ask this poor conscious computer, what did it feel like when this was happening? I remember asking him, would it hurt? And he said, it might hurt, but presumably this quantum computer would be a physicist, so it wouldn't mind. So, you see, we are into this rather science fiction realm here.
So where does all this leave the laws of physics? Because I think a lot of people would assume that's what is primary about reality, about the universe. It's sort of, that we have these seemingly intractable laws, that gravity has such and such a force, and you can sort of run through the various laws of physics, and that everything follows from that. But you're saying that is not necessarily the ultimate fabric of the universe.
You've touched on a very deep issue, which is the nature of the laws of physics. And this is the one place where physicists start to feel a bit queasy, because the traditional way of approaching doing theoretical physics is that you're given a set of laws and you get on with the job of applying them. And, of course, when experiments are done, we may find that we had a law a little bit wrong and it gets replaced by a better one and so on. But the view is that the laws are really out there. And if you try to provoke a physicist by saying, where do these laws come from, and why those laws rather than some other, you'll usually be told, this isn't really a scientific question and we never know, or it's a mystery, or maybe we'll know one day but nobody knows now.
So that's a question that's kind of off limits for most physicists.
It is, yeah. I've always felt that this is bad, that we can bring the laws of physics themselves within the scope of physical theory, but it's not there yet. And so the laws do tend to be regarded as just sort of given. But the one thing that everybody seems agreed is that these are infinitely precise, eternal, universal, absolute mathematical relationships.
Well, you have made the provocative claim that this unquestioned faith in the immutability of the laws of physics comes right out of monotheistic religion.
And oh, it does.
I think that idea would horrify most physicists. They would say they're doing anything but religious thinking here.
Yes, it makes me very angry that they get horrified. They simply don't know their history, because a matter of historical fact, our worldview, the scientific worldview, our conception of science, does come directly out of the twin traditions of Greek philosophy, which said that human beings could come to understand the world through rational reasoning and mathematics and observation and so on. In other words, it was intelligible. And monotheism, which said there is a law-like order in nature, that nature isn't just an arbitrary assemblage of phenomena and processes. It's an organized scheme of things. The whole notion that there is a created world order, and that human beings, by examining the world around them, could discern that order. And Newton and Galileo and their contemporaries, they saw that in doing their work investigating the universe, they were glimpsing the thoughts in the mind of God. They saw the mathematical relationships we've been talking about, what we might now call the laws of physics, as manifestations of God's rational plan. And that this was the exciting thing about doing science. You could glimpse the mind of God. I mean, extraordinary notion.
Obviously, you're not subscribing to monotheism. I don't think you are, at least. But you're also then questioning the immutability
today.
Of the laws of physics, too. I mean, you're sort of saying it's time to move past both these ideas.
That's right. So what I'm saying is, in a way, a plague on both your houses. So I think after 300 or 400 years of this effectively theological view, that the time has come to say, let's bring the laws of physics within the scope of scientific inquiry. Maybe the time has come to move beyond that and look at something new, more exciting, and maybe more fundamental.
I think one reason why people over the centuries, over the millennia, have been attracted to this, to monotheism or to these more religious interpretations of reality, is that it offers some framework for meaning, for why we're here. If you strip away that, is there any place for meaning in this information universe?
Yes, I believe there is, and I think you're absolutely right. When this yearning to feel that you're not just a completely useless cog in some sort of gigantic machine that is ultimately of no value or purpose or anything else. That often manifests itself as simply buying into a particular religion. I don't want to do that, but I recognize that we all try to seek something bigger than ourselves, something outside ourselves. Now, by saying that we put the laws of physics into the melting pot along with the states of the world doesn't strip that away. And this is where we reach what I regard as the absolutely key point in the whole scientific enterprise. It's not just that we observe the world, cats and dogs observe the world, but we can make sense of the world. That is, through science and mathematics, we can come to understand the processes that are going on in nature in a law-like way. When you see an apple fall, it takes a Newton or an Einstein to discern that there's an underlying invisible set of mathematical relationships which are linking all this together. And so ultimately what gives the universe, I think, words like meaning and purpose you have to be really careful with, because of course these are human constructs we're projecting onto nature. What I like to say is that there is a rational scheme of things. And what enables us to discern that rational scheme is doing science and mathematics. And human beings, for some extraordinary reason, have the ability to tap into that hidden subtext of nature and extract that deep law-like behavior that is going on.
That's Arizona State University physicist Paul Davies. He's the co-editor with Niels Henrik Gregersen of the book Information and the Nature of Reality, From Physics to Metaphysics. As Davies told Steve Paulson, there's a long history of using different models to describe the basic structure of the universe. One of the older models was known as the Music of the Spheres, which inspired some of history's great composers, like Beethoven.
The vibrations on the air are the breath of God speaking to man's soul. Music is the language of God. We musicians are as close to God as man can be. We hear his voice. We read his lips. We give birth to the children of God who sing his praise. That's what musicians are, Arnold. And if we're not that, we're nothing.
An excerpt from the film Beethoven. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, send us an email through our website at ttbook.org or visit us on our Facebook fan page. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the show called Information, number 94A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.